If you listen closely, you may notice that Mishki takes great license with some of the details surrounding the news of the day. Listen at your own amusement. Thank you.
Now, broadcasting from the border country of Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's Mishki.
Damn happy to be alive. Are you just giddy about the fact that you're breathing right now? The sun's shining. It's still October. The World Series is still on. This is still America. The weekend is here. It's legal to drink beer. Ah, the stars are looking out for all of us. I got Joshua Prager after the 6 o'clock news break. Been hunting this guy down since a year I can't remember when. Author of The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Around the World. I guess if I could be in a guy's body for 20 minutes, just one guy's body, I would have liked to have been in Bobby Thompson's body when he hit that home run in the bottom of the ninth. Just to feel what that's like. I remember Jack Morris saying in the Saints clubhouse when he was with the St. Paul Saints trying to get back into the majors, he would eventually be offered a contract with the Yankees, but they wanted him to go to AAA for a little while. And he said, what? I'm a major leaguer, man. Didn't you see me in 91? I'm not going to AAA. Those days are over. Well, then you're not getting back into the majors at all, Jack. And he said, fine. But he was in the clubhouse over at Midway Stadium here in St. Paul. And he said something about, said, if I could just give people the feeling, just the feeling of that 10th inning at the Dome in 1991, seventh game of the World Series, if I could just give everybody that, that there's no greater thing I could do with my life, just to give everybody that feeling for 15 minutes. You know, everybody seems to remember, or has at least heard it replayed, Russ Hodges' call of that shot heard around the world, WMCA. But not a lot of people remember Red Barber. That's because it wasn't nearly as dramatic.
13, Ralph Branca comes on to relieve now in the 13th meeting of these two ball clubs at the Polo Grounds this year, the 11th in the regular season. This is the second in the playoff set. Branca, who was beaten by the Giants, and beaten by the fellow that he comes on to pitch first of all to here in the last two nights, Bobby Thompson, hitting for a two-run home run. All right. So it now stands with the Giants roaring back, clawing and scratching. They have two outs remaining. They have runners at second and third, and the big one is Lachman at second base. Hartung, the pinch runner off third. Branca pitches, and Thompson takes a strike. Branca called on for his most important job in baseball career. Well, everything's the most important for all of these players as they come around. Here it is. Deering Hunt. Branca pumps. Delivers. The curve corner. And it's deep left field. It is a home run. And the
You compare something like that to Russ Hodges.
Back to pitchers. Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Down the line in third, not taking any chances. Watson without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Back of throws. There's a long drive! It's going to be, I believe, the Giants from the pellet! 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 Only Thompson hits into the large end of the left field stand. The Giants from the pellet! And they're going crazy! They're going crazy!
And while that one's beautiful, no question about it, my favorite has always been Gordon McClendon from the Liberty Broadcasting System.
Boy, I'm telling you, what they're going to say about this one, I don't know. Bobby Thompson, the batter, the outfield deep and very much to the left. Ralph Frank on the hill in favor of Newcomb. Rube Walker catching the pitch to Bobby. A strike call off the knee. Quick curve that Franco ripped right in. Franco has that tremendous overarm sinker curve that drops down. Then he has a roundhouse hook curve to right-hand batters by way of third. Extremely effective against right-handed. Two pitchers for Dodgers bullpen now. I think one of them's Rowe. Here's Bobby waiting. Franco throws. Bobby swings. Oh, that's out. The left. Going. Going. No.
I guess I'd have settled for just sitting in the stands, just being there. What's amazing about that game is what Joshua Prager found out. There had been rumors since about 62 that the Giants, in the last half of that season, had cheated, that they had set up an elaborate system for stealing signs involving a telescope, an electronic buzzer, and a guy stationed out in center field, and another guy whose job it was to throw a ball up in the air if it was a curveball, and hold it if it was a fastball. And in 2001, Joshua Prager discovers the smoking gun and eventually gets living former Giant players to admit that, yeah, DeRocher came up with the plan on the 19th of July. It was implemented on the 20th, and they stole signs the rest of the season when they were at the Polo Grounds. And, of course, Ralph Branca feels pretty good learning this. This Joshua Prager writes it in a Wall Street Journal article in 2001, and Branca feels vindicated. He had been the GOAT. Now, Bobby Thompson, while he admits that this is true, DeRocher came up with his plan and this elaborate system was in place and used, he actually wasn't looking for a read on that famous pitch. And that was clean, that home run into the left field bleachers. Prager doesn't really believe it. And we'll talk more about this story in the second hour. The Echoing Green is the book. Sometimes I think I could just sit and just play snippets of old play-by-play guys making calls, just great calls. I don't think we'll see you tomorrow night as one of the great ones. The play is one of the great ones, but the line has never worked for me. And we'll see you tomorrow night. Come on. It's okay, but it's not, do you believe in miracles? Mark?
Yeah, actually, you're right. It wasn't that great a line, but Jack Buck's voice is a lot better than yours to do.
I'll give you that.
Got an add-on to that story of Bobby Thompson. And I was 14 years old and listening to the game, an avid Dodger fan, and just died literally when that happened. But anyway.
Literally? How are you talking to me
now? No, I mean figuratively speak. I'm sorry. But the guy on third base, Clint Hartung, was there because he was a pinch runner for Don Mueller, who broke his ankle sliding into third. And why on earth did DeRocher pick his biggest, slowest man to be a pinch runner? Well, the reason being, and this is from Sabre Baseball Research also, and you can ask your guest about it, is because all during the game, DeRocher has been calling Newcomb racial names. And he knows that if Newcomb comes out of the game, Newcomb is coming after him. So he takes and puts his biggest man on third base to protect him when they bring in a new pitcher. And this is not my making up. This is from Sabre. And it's a great story. And, of course, you know, he didn't need to be fast, but why would he put his slowest man on third base? He did.
It's hard to imagine that. Obviously, there was a ton of that back then, but it would have been interesting to run around with a tape player and just hear the racial attacks through the...
And, but nothing was unbelievable with DeRocher. I mean, when he was with the Yankees, he stole money from his teammates' pockets in the lockers. I mean, DeRocher was just... He was low down. And a great manager and a great name. But, I mean, this guy, nothing... You couldn't put anything past him.
Larry King said, "No day of my life since that day has brought me the pain of that day."
Well,
Dick Schaap said, "When Bobby Thompson hit the home run, my childhood ended."
You know, that's a great line. I mean, I was only 14, but I mean, it was just a killer. And then 55, they vindicated a little bit by winning a series, but losing to the Giants. And the little trivia question, of course, is who was on deck, you know? And Willie Mays was on deck. But anyway, I'll enjoy listening to your guest. That's going to be fun.
Thanks a lot for calling in.
You bet. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
AM 1500, KSTP.
Did you hear the news about what's happening in Brooklyn? We really got the blues about what's happening in Brooklyn. It ain't official yet. We hope official it don't get. But beware, my friend, and let me warn you. They're thinking of taking the bums to California. Let's keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn. Hey. A house is not a home without some love. Don't let them leave our premises. L.A. will be their nemesis, 'cause Brooklyn fits the Dodgers like a glove.
Mischke here, AM 1500 KSTP, High Speed Chase at the board, technical director, studio engineer, production wizard, traffic god, Kenny Olson also here.
Hi, Tom.
What happened to your voice, man? Are you doing something?
I'm okay now.
Oh.
A Royce-like gas attack.
Oh,
there,
okay.
Right as you were saying hello.
You know, are his different from Joe's?
You know, if you heard them side by side on the same piece of tape, I don't think you'd notice.
Okay.
I don't think you'd notice.
But the idea is that Royce has more of them?
Yeah, they somehow just got dubbed the Royce-like gas attack.
Well, but he is hammerhead on the Diet Coke, right?
Yeah, it's from all that, right, carbonation. Yeah.
What is the... I've known some alcoholics in my day. The guys I know, I mean, 12-pack of soda pop goes down some days.
Yeah, when you're mixing it with booze, that's a lot of pop, boy. That's rotting your teeth.
No, this is...
What do you mean?
I'm talking about Reformed.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, they no longer drink alcohol, so... But they'll go through a 12-pack some days. I know a lot of guys who drink a lot of Pepsi. Now, how much Diet Coke do you figure Patrick drinks?
I bet you he's good for a 6-pack or more. I would just guess. I'm not sure.
That can't be healthy.
No.
Wonder what that does to your system after years. I realize it isn't something after days, but after, and not months, but after years, I wonder what happens. God. I wonder if it isn't better if he just... goes back to the hooch.
Oh, God. Oh, Tom. This report brought to us by Tires Plus. East 94 from Highway 55, Olson Memorial, over to Highway 280 here on the Midway. 20 minutes there. Down on the strip, East 494, Bush Lake Road to 34th, 26 minutes. The eastbound crosstown, seeing 20 minutes now between 169 and the Common Squeeze. North 35W running a little thick due to an earlier left lane blocker at 36th Avenue, about 10-15 minutes from 394 up to 36th Avenue. Snow, sleet, freezing weather on the way. Thinking tires? Think Tires Plus. Snow tires in stock. All season tires in stock. Get ready now. Think Tires Plus. That is your AM 1500 real-time traffic, Tom.
What do you got planned for the weekend?
Doing some kind of school event for the boys' elementary school tomorrow, and then we're heading up to the farm, the boy and I.
You're not going to have to get in a little bunny outfit or something, are you? What are you doing at school?
I have no idea. Some kind of spaghetti fundraising deal thing. I've been promised that we'll be out of there by noon.
And then you and the boy are going to the farm, huh?
Yep.
Boy, I bet, you know, tomorrow could be the day that a memory is born that you think back on when you're 85 years old, if you make it that long, and that could be the big memory on your deathbed, what you and the boy do on the farm tomorrow.
How old is he? He's 6. I'm not worried about my memories. I'm worried about creating positive and good memories for the kid,
mm-hmm.
You know, showing him a good time.
Well, that's true. I mean, it might be his memory when he's 85 years old. I remember when I was 6. It might be his first memory. Often, when you're real old, 6 is about the best you can do when you go back.
Yeah, you're right.
So that's, all of a sudden, that I'm putting a lot on tomorrow for you.
Yeah.
The pressure's on.
Jeez.
I hope, you know, you don't accidentally... Do you have a thrasher?
A thrasher? Or a combine? Nope.
Yeah.
Just a tractor.
My grandpa, and I'm not a farm guy, but my grandpa always used to threaten to put me in the thrashing machine, which he meant were his fists. But there was one, right?
That's such a grandpa thing to say, isn't it?
Which, with a German accent, it doesn't sound funny.
Show me your papers, little boy.
Very calmly just say, one more time, and I put you in the thrashing machine.
The thrashing machine.
You know, today you could easily get him arrested, but back then you just put up with it.
Yeah.
I remember one time I was getting the business from my dad, and I said, because it was the 70s, and I was learning some things, and I said, you know, I could call a social worker right now. It got worse after that. It got much worse.
Well, into the closet with you, little Tom. We'll see you in a week.
Thanks, Kitty. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming up on the top of the hour. That's Roadside Olson. This is the old broadcast. Mishki here. Coming up on 8 o'clock. What the hell? When do I do the show? Coming up on noon. ABC has an update, and then we'll have a local bit of chit-chat with, I think it's Soft Hands McQuaid tonight. Soft Hands filling in for Wildcat, was filling in for John Hyde, who is off for a few days. Then we'll be back with Joshua Prager and The Echoing Green, the untold story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the shot heard around the world. And what is that untold story? The Giants cheated. It's a Black Sox scandal all over again. It's a sad, sad, sad deal. KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. Stick around. If you want your childhood destroyed and all your dreams cut up and your life left in shards on the floorboards of your home.
Right now, partly cloudy and 56 at the Talk Station, AM 1500, KSTP. And now back to Mishki.
Thank you.
it's Mishki.
Sudden death game in the playoff between the faltering Dodgers and the stretch-running Giants. New York is baseball wild over a climactic wind-up to a pulse-tingling National League pennant. Leo DeRocher's miracle team spotted the Dodgers a 13-game advantage in mid-August and overtook them at the finish line. Lorraine Day, Mrs. DeRocher, has her fingers crossed because this is it. In the first inning, the Giants' 23-game winner, Sal Magley, walks two men. And with one out...
I don't think back then they called it a walk-off home run, did they? October 3rd, 51, that landmark date in baseball history. Giants Thompson hits that home run against the Brooklyn Dodgers. Third game of a postseason playoff series. Hands the Giants the National League pennant and sends their rivals to the bars. Sends them to the saloons. Branca, the pitcher, is left lying on the floor of the clubhouse afterwards crying. Just crying. And he knows the photographers are clicking pictures. He just turns his face away. He's laying on the floor, just weeping. That the Giants subsequently lost the World Series to the Yanks is just a side note. No one really cares about that. All people cared about in this country, and this game was known about all over the country, was this Dodgers-Giants matchup. It was huge, and it was fueled by a ton of media attention. I had a chance a couple hours ago to interview Joshua Prager, author of the book The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the Shot Heard Around the World. We'll play it for you now. Mishki here, AM 1500 KSTP. My guest this evening, Joshua Prager, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He is author of the book, The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Round the World. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
How many interviews have you done since this book came out, roughly?
Well, I don't know. Under 100.
Before I ask my first question pertaining to this story, what the hell is it like doing 100 interviews? I mean, are you sick of talking about this book? And you can be honest.
Well, to tell you the truth, sometimes I can anticipate the question and know what I'm going to say, but luckily for me, it is a subject I really care about. I spent 5.5 years on it, and believe it or not, it wasn't a drag, so that should tell you something. I really care about the guys in the book.
Going off the jacket of your book, the 51 regular season was as good as over. Dodgers led the Giants by 3 runs, 3 outs to go in their third and final playoff game. Not one time in the history of Major League Baseball, not one time in 278 preceding playoff and World Series games had a team overcome a 3-run deficit in the ninth. New York rallies, and on October 3rd, 1951, there it is, Thompson hits a home run off Ralph Branca. The Giants win the pennant. People who don't even follow baseball know about this. Your book, The Echoing Green, follows everything that happens after that moment and some of what happened leading up to that moment. And follows in particular a couple of key players, the guy who swung that bat and the guy who threw that pitch. But where this idea for this book is born is when you're doing research for a Wall Street Journal article, I believe back in 2001, correct?
That's right.
And the The thing that I am still struggling with after looking at the book, looking at some reviews, looking at some interviews, is it seems something big happened in 2001, something that you did, and yet it also seems like for a lot of people, this was also kind of already accepted that in order for the Giants to have that extraordinary last part of their season, and in order for Bobby Thompson to pull off that miracle, that shot heard around the world, something that a lot of people feel comfortable calling cheating had to occur. What's the difference between the talk from 1962 on, when rumors of this stealing signs business with a telescope was first talked about? What happened in 2001 with your Wall Street Journal article that made it something bigger?
Well, basically, beginning in 1962, like you say, that is when the rumors of the Giants sign stealing came out. A man named Joe Reichler at the AP wrote an article, and he had some basics correct. He said that someone in the center field clubhouse at the Polo Grounds was peering signals through a telescope, and somehow they used a buzzer system to alert the batter to what was upcoming. He did not know any details at all. There was not a single player mentioned by name. They didn't know when it started. They didn't know when it ended. And as a result of that, everyone poo-pooed it. No one believed it. They didn't even have a source who was saying it was true. The man who, in fact, did tell the reporter about this was a guy named Danny O'Connell, who wasn't even on the team in 51, but had been a teammate of some of the men later on and was the first to report this. So no one wanted to believe it either. And because there were no details, they didn't have to. And all of the Giant players simply lied. Thompson, DeRocher, the manager, all of them. They said it's not true. And the only person who really wanted it to be true was Ralph Branca, the only one in the country. He found out about it in 1954 when a teammate of his on the Tigers, after he'd been let go by the Dodgers, named Ted Gray, had told him about this. And the difference between 62 and 2001, when I wrote about it, I guess, first of all, time had passed, 50 years, and people were a little bit more open to reexamining this great moment and saying, okay, it's still a great moment, but it's good to know what actually happened. And more importantly, I was able to uncover every single detail. I found the actual telescope they used, a Wallenfeck telescope. I found which window they stole signs from, the fourth window. I found a picture of the window that showed wire mesh cut out where the telescope went. I found the day they started, which was July 20th, and the identities of the spy, Herman Franks, the electrician, Abe Chadwick, and the sign relayer, Sal Evars. So because I knew all these details, no one could poo-poo it. And that is why I suppose there was such a reaction to it. And what I cared was even less about the effect of the sign stealing on the game than the effect of the secret on the lives of these old men.
The Echo in Green, the untold story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the shot heard round the world. We'll cut out early here. There's a lot more to go. Stick around. It's an extraordinary story.
Now, back to Mishki on AM 1500, KSTP.
Back to pitchers, Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Down the line at third, not taking any chances. Watson without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Branca throws. There's a last chance! It's going to be, I believe, the Giants from the pellet! 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 Bobby Thompson hits it in the margin! The Giants from the pellet! And they're going crazy! They're going crazy!
Jones, who lived two blocks away. Let me tell you, gave me some advice.
Mishki, AM 1500 KSTP. What did Red Smith, the great New York sports writer, write after that game? That famous paragraph at the start of his column. Now it is done. The story ends. And there's no way to tell it. The art of fiction is dead. Reality has strangled invention. Only the utterly impossible, the inexpressibly fantastic, can ever be plausible again. Red didn't know about the telescope. The Echoing Green, the untold story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca and the Shot Heard Round the World by Joshua Prager. I interviewed Joshua earlier this afternoon. We'll continue with that interview now. When the article came out in 2001, were you vilified?
Well, it's interesting. Most people, most readers, most fans, even most ballplayers, were not against this. They were happy to have had the truth told. In fact, Bobby Thompson himself went on air, on TV and in radio, and he said, I feel like I got out of jail. That's what he said. And Ralph Branca used the word catharsis. I have all those tapes, and that was very moving for me to know that it was nice for them to unburden themselves of a secret. But as the time went by, people in his camp, his friends, his family, Giant fans, they were sort of upset. There was like a debate that went on, and it was fueled by the only group that was upset at this and at me, and those were the old sports writers. Jim Boughton, who wrote Ball 4, had experienced something like this, and I experienced it. They called my article scandalous, and one of them, an older sports writer, didn't even want to shake my hand at a dinner. So it was kind of amazing.
When you think about that, it's not because you didn't have the goods. You had all the evidence.
Right.
It was that you told the story.
That's exactly right. And the thing was, if the players themselves are open about a story, you'd think that the writers would be. But that wasn't the case at first.
And I also assume that diehard Dodger fans, Brooklyn Dodger fans, must have felt a tremendous sense of, well, this explains everything, because they were obviously miserable over how the last part of their season had gone and how this game had gone. The one thing that makes it difficult for me to understand how this sign stealing is effective is, why doesn't the batting average of the Giants
improve? Isn't that amazing? You're right. The batting average did, in fact, not improve markedly at all in this time. It was the pitching that did. And that was one thing I wanted people to know. I don't have an agenda. I simply
right.
want to tell people what happened, and I go into great detail about that. And as Rob Nyer wrote at ESPN.com, we don't know how they would have performed had they not done this. One of the things that did happen was during this stretch, they had a lot more late-inning comebacks than ever before. And one of the players told me, well, that's because we didn't always use the signs. We only used it when we had to. The truth of the matter is, I don't know why some batters wouldn't perform better than others. And obviously, when Bobby Thompson came to bat, he still had to hit the pitch, even if you know what's coming. Basically what I told myself is, I will tell people what happened, but I'm not going to tell them how to feel.
Right. It's interesting what happened, regardless of how the thing played out, but I'm fascinated by, because I don't fully understand baseball well enough to know the nuances of what occurs when you steal signals.
A lot of the players told me that they don't like to know what's coming. It's a minority, but there's several players like that. That it's better to simply react to the pitch. That it's distracting otherwise to know a certain type of pitch is coming, and that if you get fouled up, if you're expecting a curve and there's actually a fastball, it's even dangerous. But for the most part, most players really do benefit from knowing what's coming. They feel that it gives them a leg up, and that's why people try to steal signs, even without a telescope, just peering in off of second base and relaying it to the batter. But for the most part, we should
mention that that's legal.
Yes, that is legal. And in fact, even stealing signs with a telescope every time there is one of these episodes, baseball goes crazy. It throws its arms up in the air and it says, we have to suspend these players, we have to do something about it. But technically, it's not outlawed by the game. There is no real rule on the record books outlawing the stealing of signs, even with a telescope. It's just not in the spirit of the game.
Okay, help me out with this then. When I hear people say stealing signs is fine, but you're not supposed to do it by any mechanical means, where's that coming from?
Right. That is basically, like I say, even though there isn't a rule, there has been that divide for more than 100 years, and I give a whole history of that in the book. There are episodes of these cheating with a telescope back into the 1800s. Philadelphia did it. And the consensus was at the end of the season that you just better not use a telescope. It's not fair. And they resolved that they would pass a rule banning the stealing of signs with mechanical means, but they never did. And that happened several times through baseball. Ty Cobb wrote something that makes that divide. Christy Mathewson says the same thing, that it's okay with your naked eye, but not with a telescope. So even though it was never officially outlawed, that was pretty much the consensus in baseball.
And in this particular case, mechanical means means more than just the telescope, because once the telescope picked up the sign, what happened next?
Yeah, it was basically a three-part process. Herman Franks peered through the Wallensack telescope. He then pressed a button, a push button, installed in that fourth window, and that button sounded a buzzer in the right center field bullpen. The Polo Grounds happened to be the only ballpark in all of baseball that had the bullpens where the pitchers warm up in fair territory. So it was ideally suited to the stealing of signs. And a man out there, once he got the buzz, a coded buzz, generally one for a fastball, two for an off-speed pitch, he then relayed it to the batter. So it was very quick. It was spying, transmitting with a buzzer, and then relaying. And they got that down to just a few seconds. And of course, between every pitch, there are about 20 seconds. There were 23 seconds between the two fastballs Branca threw Thompson, and there are about half as many seconds between the time the catcher gives the sign and the pitcher throws the ball.
And what you're trying to determine, in essence, is fastball or curve?
Generally, yes. That's really the, if you have a fastball coming, it's a lot easier to know it's coming because you can start your swing sooner.
Branca throws to Thompson a fastball.
His first pitch was a fastball right over the plate. Thompson did not swing. He took it for a strike. And the second pitch was an inside fastball. And Thompson swung and hit a line drive that went over the 315-foot sign to left field stands. And the Giants won the pennant.
You just report on it, you say, and I respect that. But you must have a feeling of whether or not you think, hey, they won this because they cheated.
Well, here's what I know. That even if it helped them win just one game, then there wouldn't have been a playoff.
Right.
The Giants and the Dodgers finished in an exact tie. And do I think that happened? Yes.
Well, sure.
So do I think the cheating helped them win the pennant? Yes.
Right. It's pretty... if we know for a fact now that starting July 20th, they stole signs, we know it had to help them win one game.
That's exactly right. And you know, what I go into a lot in the book is why, you know, there have been a lot of episodes of sign stealing and no one cares. The reason people cared about this is because it involved baseball's greatest moment. And literally millions of people remember where they were when Thompson hit the home run. And there are a lot of reasons for that. It involved, of course, this incredible rivalry. The Giants and the Dodgers were baseball's greatest rivalry. In the 1870s, the New York Times wrote that their rivalry was unparalleled in the history of the game. Between the teams from New York and Brooklyn, the precursors to the Giants and the Dodgers. Another reason everyone remembered was it capped this incredible comeback. The Giants trailed the Dodgers by 13 and a half games on August 11th. And it happened in New York, which was the hub of baseball back then. There were three teams, and at least one team was in the World Series every single year in a 10-year stretch except one. And of course, like you read earlier, it was unprecedented from a baseball point of view. It was the first home run ever to end a playoff or World Series, and the first time ever, it hasn't happened since either, that a team trailing by three runs in the bottom of the ninth inning won the game. And there were other reasons that it transcended the ball field, like, for example, the fact that it was the first ever nationally televised sporting event ever, this playoff. And so people all over the country had a chance to see this baseball live. And it was an event. People standing in front of shop fronts, going into the living rooms, the one guy who had a TV down the street. And, of course, it also had the very famous radio call. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. And all of these reasons came together. It was sort of like a perfect storm. And that's why I think everyone remembers where they were when it happened.
You're listening to Joshua Prager, author of The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Round the World. And we'll continue with Joshua after these messages. Stick around.
Mishki, AM 1500, KSTP.
Welcome back. T.D. Mishki here, AM 1500, KSTP. I'm speaking with Joshua Prager, author of The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Round the World, a book you can find at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, or at your local independent bookstore. If you want to remember the title, The Echoing Green, you can also remember Prager as the author's name, and I'm sure they'll order it for you. People listening to this interview should not conclude that, despite the fact that this was a burden off the shoulders of Bobby Thompson, this acknowledgement that in that particular season there was this great secret that the team had kept for decades about how they stole signs, they should not conclude that Thompson thus is admitting that he knew the pitch that was coming from Branca.
You're right. What he did was, ultimately, he was very forthcoming about the fact that the Giants had been stealing signs down the stretch and that he was among the players who not only wanted the signs but benefited from them. And in fact, his was one of the few averages that really was much higher after they started stealing signs. But he equivocated when I asked about that very at-bat against Branca. He said in the article I wrote for the Wall Street Journal, I'd have to say more no than yes, you know, when I asked if he had the stolen signs. He said, I don't like to think of something taking away from it. And finally, he said, my answer is no. I was always proud of that swing. And, you know, I think the fact that he equivocated was telling. And I also think something else that's telling is this. All of these years, when he's been asked about the home run, not about the sign stealing, he told a story that sort of accommodated his version of whether or not he got the signs, even though he wasn't speaking of the signs. What he said all those years was that he was distracted just before the at-bat with Branca. He was distracted by an injury. Don Mueller had stepped on third base awkwardly when Whitey Lockman hit a double and he tore tendons in his ankle, and Bobby Thompson had to run down to third base and see how his friend was doing. And he always said, I wasn't aware of anyone else in the ballpark but me, he said. And presumably he was speaking also about the signed relayer in right center field, Sal Ebars. Because how else would you understand that a batter would not peek over the second baseman's head to get the sign if he was simply not in like a trance? And what he said was, I was like a mechanical doll. In other words, going up there. And he said he psyched himself up. He called himself an SOB and he hit the home run. One of the things that I came to know about Bobby very well is that his biggest problem his whole life was not giving himself credit for things. He was always self-deprecating to a fault, and that, in fact, is one of the reasons why he and Branca were able to stand side by side all these years. Branca was this proud man who propped himself up, despite the fact that he had lost this incredible game. And Thompson was this sort of meek man who always put himself down, and so they were able to stand side by side. But on that final point, as you say, he maintains that he did not have the sign for the pitch he hit for a home run.
It's funny to think of him equivocating there. I find myself just thinking about what that means, wanting to give him the benefit of a doubt that maybe he honestly doesn't know if.
I think you're right. I think that's a possibility.
Yeah.
He had never really confronted this thought until I talked to him about it. Never. And so maybe enough time had gone by that, you know, his memory of the event had become the event itself, and he really wasn't really sure.
Do the Giants feel, the former Giants you talked to, do they feel kind of sheepish about this? Is it Is it something they admit now with sort of a feeling of, okay, you caught us?
Some of them, you know, they all had very different reactions. Some of them did not admit it at all. Alvin Dark, the captain and the shortstop, he would not talk about it, and he didn't admit it. And Herman Franks, who was the actual spy, he didn't want to talk about it either. But most of them did. Monty Irvin talked to me about the meeting that Leo DeRocher called on July 19th when he decided to discuss this with the players. Davey Williams said, I have carried that for 49 years, so it was a difficult thing when I talked to them about it. But a lot of them were very open with me, like the pitcher Al Corwin, and like I said, Bobby Thompson. And no, the first thing Bobby Thompson said to me when I called him about this, he said, it's something I've never been proud of. And he also said, I'm far from perfect, put that down. So yes, it did bother him, and it bothered a lot of the players. And I think that is the hardest thing about cheating, that you, even when you don't talk about it with other people, you know yourself what happened.
How common was this, do you think, in Major League Baseball? Was this as elaborate as you would have gotten, or was this a, was DeRocher just sort of some evil genius figuring this out?
I will tell you, I contextualize this a lot in the book. At Chapter 8, I talk about this. Stealing signs was a big part of the game. This was a very elaborate scheme, though, and this was much more advanced and successful than almost all the other schemes before or since. A few others were successful as well. The 1940 Tigers did this. And in fact, believe it or not, the 1954 Giants did it. They did it a few years later when they won the World Series. So, you know, it helped. This was a very elaborate scheme, and it was pretty much undetectable. No one had any idea what was going on, certainly not the millions of people who were tuning into that game. And one of my favorite things in the book was speaking to many of those people and finding people who talked about it, people like John Steinbeck and Jack Kerouac, who wrote about the home run, people like Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the spies on death row in Sing Sing, who wrote about the home run, the bank robber Willie Sutton, and the mobster Willie Moretti, who was actually killed as a result of this home run. All of these stories, Arthur Miller, the playwright, who had just written Death of a Salesman, he remembered to me in a letter these incredible screams that he heard that turned out to be coming from his producer, Kermit Blumgarten. And I have a very fun section in the book about people who cried, who screamed, who dropped whatever they were holding, all the different things that happened to people when they fainted, even someone who died. And if some of your listeners have a memory of this, they can share it with me on my website at www.joshuaprager.com. And on that website, I also have a place where you can hear different radio calls of the home run, not just the famous call by Russ Hodges where he screams the Giants win the pennant, but also the call of Gordon McClendon and the call of Red Barber. And I also have newsreel of the home run. And they can also see reviews of the book and other things like that. So it's sort of a fun site.
Once again, can you give out that website once more?
It's www.joshuaprager.com.
Okay, great. Can you, I'm going to backpedal just a little bit. Can you walk us through that little two-week process when you were writing the article for the, or researching the article for the Wall Street Journal? There was a two-week period between when you first entertained the notion of pursuing this to where you all of a sudden had what you felt was a smoking gun?
Well, you're right. The research and the writing took 4 months. But it was 2 weeks before when I first got the idea, and I'll tell you how that came, to when I wrote my proposal to my editors, and okay. I really started in on it in earnest. I was first told about this rumor from a man named Barry Halper, who was a minority owner of the Yankees a few years ago. He has since passed away, and he's famous for being the father of baseball memorabilia, incidentally. He had all these incredible things that he sold at auction at Sotheby's. And he was the man who mentioned to me the rumors that the Giants had stolen signs. And I asked him if he thought they were true, and he said no. And I said, why not? And he said, two reasons. One, Ralph Branca is the one who told me, and clearly the pitcher who lost has a vested interest in believing that he was wronged. And the second reason, he said, is it's baseball's most famous moment. It would have been proved by now. This was, after all, the eve of the 50th anniversary. But I said to myself, you know, if I can prove that, that would be quite a story. And it would be interesting to see how keeping this secret all these years affected these men. And so I got a list of anyone who had been on the Giants in 1951 for even the proverbial cup of coffee, forgetting just the stars, men like Spider Jorgensen and Henry Shenz and Red Hardy. All these men, no one really, and Artie Wilson, no one had paid attention to. And I started speaking to them one by one. And the first person who told me, you know, I spoke to Wes Westrum, the catcher, and he was very nice, and he said, look, if anyone would know about this, it would be the catcher, and, you know, I'm sorry, but it's just not true. And then a few more players, and like I said, Alvin Dark got very angry, and he said, I know nothing about it, I know nothing about it, I know nothing about it, and then he hung up. And I thought to myself, clearly he knows something about it. And then finally it was Spider Jorgensen, the man I mentioned, who told me that in 1952, the year after the pennant, he was on the minor leagues with the Oakland Oaks in the Pacific Coast League, and he went out to a drink one night. It's amazing how many stories started that way. They went out for a drink.
Yeah.
He went out for a drink with Henry Shenz, utility player on the Giants in 51. And Shenz taken off waivers from the Pirates to the Giants in 51, the very day that Jorgensen played his last game and was let go. And Shenz told Jorgensen this night that, you know, hey, right after you left, we started stealing signs, and they used my telescope. And so he's telling me this story, and I was thinking, oh, my God, no one's ever known anything about Shenz. And I called his family. He had passed away in 1988, and his sister didn't know anything about it. His first child I spoke to didn't know about it, his daughter. And then finally one of his sons said, oh, yeah, I know all about that. We still have the telescope. I said, you have the telescope? He said, and I flew to Westford, Massachusetts, And there, in fact, was the telescope. And I took it to Sky and Telescope magazine, and they told me that such a telescope was perfect for looking fingers 500 feet away.
And what was it like to find the telescope? I don't know quite what to compare that moment to, but it, you know, we're talking about, even though it's just sports here, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about an extraordinary moment in 20th century history in America, and you're suddenly holding the smoking gun, more or less.
You're exactly right. It was sort of overwhelming. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, I told myself, just follow this through, take it through. And really, my plan was to superimpose something no one knew about atop something everybody knew about.
Right.
What I mean by that is everyone knows about this magical season that did transcend sport. You know, it became the shot heard around the world. And I said, just figure out what no one knew, this scheme and the players involved, and then figure out the details and lay it right on top of the season. And that's one of the things I think people like, to sort of see the private destinies of people and how they intersect with famous public events. And my favorite person to write about in the whole book was a man named Abe Chadwick. And he was the electrician on the Giants. But he loved the Brooklyn Dodgers. So here you have, loves the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he works for the New York Giants. And sadly, he died 1 month to the day after the home run. So his story was fascinating and runs throughout the book.
More with Joshua Prager and the Echoing Green after this. I asked four realtors I know who they recommend when it comes to mortgages. Obviously, when they're involved in the sale of a house, they want to make sure that their client is going with a top-notch mortgage company because they want this deal to go smoothly. I asked them who they recommend. In each case, they had a list. Their list was sometimes only two mortgage companies long, sometimes four. Homestead was the first one mentioned in three out of the four cases, and the second one mentioned in the fourth case. Homestead Mortgage has that reputation. The deal's going to go through. It's going to be smooth. They'll be there at the closing. Everything will be in order. It's a lock. If realtors are recommending Homestead, then it shouldn't really matter whether or not I am. They know a hell of a lot more. Go with their recommendation. Homestead Mortgage, 651-490-5555.
Now, back to Mishki on AM 1500, KSTP.
The greatest baseball game ever played in the history of the game. now tainted because of the revelations of Joshua Prager? Some would say so. We go to our last segment now of a pre-recorded interview with Joshua Prager, author of The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the Shot Heard Round the World. The story could only have been told at the moment you told it or before, but not later, because in the last few years, a lot of these guys have died off.
That's right. Since I started doing the book, 8 members of the 1951 Giants died. And, of course, the most important 2 people for me were Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca. And in the beginning, as just sort of a writer or a reporter, I was desperate that they stayed alive for my book. And then as time went by, I was desperate that they stayed alive as friends. I really got to know them, and they're good men. And I came to care of them. And I was so happy to get to know them and honored by their friendship. And I'm just thrilled that they're still around and going strong.
And this friendship, at what point do these two guys start hanging out together for card signings or for promotional events? When does that start that they are forced or maybe enjoy each other's company, but are together often representing this moment?
I'll tell you what happened. 6 days after the home run, at Game 6 of the World Series, Ralph Branca went to the game, and one of the photographers there, a man named Herb Sharfman, spotted him and realized, hey, I have this photo op, and he called Bobby Thompson over. And Ralph Branca posed choking Bobby Thompson. And this picture ran in the paper. And that was the first time they were paired together after the home run. And then, in February, at the Baseball Writers Association of America dinner, they sang a song together that one of the sports writers had written, a man named Arthur Mann. He had taken a popular 1951 song called Because of You by Tony Bennett, and he had changed the lyrics. And it was a very beautiful song that he wrote. This man used the lyrics about Thompson and Branca, the hero and the goat. And when they sang this song, people literally started to cry. It was a very moving song. And Ed Sullivan heard about this and asked the men to perform it just a few days later on his show, The Ed Sullivan Show. And that was when they really burst out onto the scene as a hero and a goat that was paired. If you take any 99% of the other examples of the hero and the goat, no one cared. For example, just the season previous, the very last day of the season, Dick Sisler had a home run off Don Newcomb to win the pennant against the Dodgers. No one remembers that, let alone paired Sisler and Newcomb. And that goes back to all the reasons we were saying that people remember this moment. But getting back to your question, so then, you know, they were then paired, and then they kind of went apart. And in 1983... a man who was a reverend paired them together at a card show. This was just starting memorabilia. He asked these men, hey, would you come and sign things and talk to people, and we'll pay you for it. And it was so popular, and fans were so unbelievably excited to see these two men who had sort of either it was the happiest moment of their childhood or the worst moment of their childhood, that they started appearing more and more, and they've been doing it for the 23 years since.
And let people know what happens when 2001 rolls around, your article comes out, and now you have one of the men, the pitcher, Branca, relieved and feeling maybe a little vindicated, but also looking over at Thompson and seeing a guy who's saying, no, I didn't read that.
Right.
I didn't know what pitch was coming. And then Branca, in turn, saying, oh, he knew that was coming. You could tell by the way he jumped on it so aggressively like a tiger.
Right.
Don't they come apart a little bit there?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the first time they came apart was way, way back in 1954 when Branca found out that the Giants had been stealing signs. By his own admission, he became a very angry man. And then he had another trauma. The first trauma, of course, was the home run. The second trauma was when he found out. And the third trauma was when, in 1962, the rumor came out and no one cared. He thought things would change, and they didn't. And so they had a really difficult relationship. And then, like I said, their relationship started to improve little by little in 1983 when they spent this time together. But they never confronted the secret that both men knew, never. And then finally, when my article came out and they did confront it, they grew much closer very quickly. They were like, they were so relieved, and they unburdened themselves. But then, you're right, about a month or two later, when they're, like I said earlier, their respective camps had at them, and Branca's people said, hey, don't be so magnanimous. They cheated. And Branca started saying, look, he leapt on it like a tiger leaping on a wounded antelope. He knew what was coming. And Thompson's people said, hey, forget him. You won, and he lost, and stop being so humble. Start taking credit for this moment. And so they definitely came apart. They really did. But then over the next few years, as I was writing my book, they came back together, and their friendship was even better. They had finally confronted this, and Thompson, even though, yes, the team had been stealing signs, like I said earlier, he had trouble taking credit for things his whole life. And he finally, because Ralph was chirping up more about them stealing signs, he finally forcefully took credit for this moment. And he said, you know what, I won and you lost that day. And that has helped him a tremendous amount. And Ralph Branca, on the other hand, feels, like he said to me, you loosened my lips, I can now talk about this. So ultimately, it was a good thing for both of them, the airing of a secret, as I think inevitably it always is.
It's an extraordinary story. It really is. The Echoing Green by Joshua Prager, the untold story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the shot heard round the world. I want to thank you so much for your time and 5 years of hard work putting this together. And I hope, even though this might be your 101st interview, that it was no more painful than the rest of them.
No, it was great. This was a much longer interview than I normally have. We had a chance to get into the real heart of the book, and I appreciate that. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. And can you give out, just because I'm interested in that website, can you give that out again for the listeners?
Sure. It's www.joshuaprager.com, and that's where you'll see the radio, you'll hear the radio calls and see the newsreel and see pictures of the players and get a real sense of the moment.
And people can also include their memories. Did you say that was a possibility?
Yes, you can tell me where you were. There's a place to click on and tell me, and in future editions of the book, I can include the more sort of unique stories. And, of course, you can also just go to Amazon.com and get the book there.
By the way, I understand, reading one of the interviews, that your father was a big Giants fan.
A big Dodgers fan, rather. That's right, he was. So he sort of gets a kick out of it now that his kid was the one who, if maybe, lessened the pain just a little bit of 1951.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you again, Joshua. Take care of yourself.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
The Echoing Green. Prager apparently had a story yesterday in the Wall Street Journal having to do with this Kenny Rogers cheating situation, tying it into some of what he wrote about in his book, The Echoing Green, if you want to find that. Back after the top of the hour news, KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. Stick around.
The St. Cloud Times newspaper reports that police are looking for the person who set fire to the running track at South Junior High School in St. Cloud. The fire melted parts of the track, causing $210,000 in damage. It will need to be completely rebuilt. 5 Eyewitness News weather, partly cloudy, windy, and cooler overnight, 32 for a low. On Saturday, tomorrow, partly sunny and cooler with a high of 46. And then a bit of a warming trend begins Sunday, windy and warmer with a high of 60. 56 degrees now at AM 1500 KSTP.
Now, broadcasting from the inner city tarmac of University Avenue, it's Mishkin.
Do you like being scared? Do you like being terrified? It's haunted house season. Soft Hands McQuaid, you like being scared?
Sure, why not?
Why not? Because It's scary being scared.
It's a thrill.
I don't know. Sometimes when you see a guy running at you with a big knife,
well,
and he's going to kill you, it's not thrilling because you want to live.
Well, we want it to be a controlled experience. If you know that going in, then it's a thrill.
There's a haunted house I want you people to experience. It's not for little kids. I mean, maybe starting at about 11 it'd be okay. Maybe 10. Don't go younger than that. But it is a haunted house that has done very well, and it's done for charity. It costs nothing. 679 Marie. It's at Marie and Dodd in Mendota Heights. Large house, attached garage, large yard, scary stuff, haunting. Sometimes brutally frightening and excruciatingly terrifying and hideously horrible, and yet wondrously uplifting in the soft hands McQuaid sense that it's controlled. Here's the situation.
Mm-hmm.
You simply have to bring a non-perishable food item.
Oh, that's
bring,
great.
Yeah, it's for stock in the food shelves mm-hmm. in Twin Cities.
Good idea.
And you're in. That's all you got to bring. Just get a can of food. Get a box of ramen noodles. Get some what's this stuff called? Chuck E. Cheese? Cheese Orito? Cheese Whiz? What's this stuff called? Macaroni cheese. Thank you. And head out there. It's out on Marie and Mendota Heights. Go down by Dodd. You'll probably, once you get to Dodd, start to sense it already. Start to hear it. You want to learn more about it, go to this website. ScareTheFoodOutOfYou.com.
Ooh, good title.
ScareTheFoodOutOfYou.com. And you can hear the story. Here's the situation. It's a wonderful deal. If you love, instead of being scared, doing the scaring, they need volunteers, particularly for tomorrow night. If you only can do it for one night, if you can help out for one night, it's just in the evening tomorrow, you could... help out the less fortunate, have a fun time scaring the pants off folks, and have a little feeling going home that you participated in this year's Halloween in all the right ways.
Are volunteers required to be hideous and grotesque?
They'll help you get there by out there, unless you have some stuff already. But if you don't have anything, or you don't, if you're just a human being with pair of khakis, a polo shirt, and a baseball cap, like most of America, you still can wander on out there. And here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to take down a phone number and call and let them know you can help out. Here's a funny thing, Soft Hands.
Mm-hmm.
They called the churches, figuring out churches would have volunteers to send to them. But churches tend to distance themselves
mm-hmm.
from Halloween.
I understand.
It's not one they want to participate in.
Right.
So they're hurting. They have some volunteers, but it takes a lot of people to put together a really good haunted house. What I want you to do is call 952-457-5506. Now, you didn't remember that number, and I understand, which is why I'm going to give it out four times. 952-457-5506. And Speed, you can write this down in case people don't get it and want to call you. Get it from you off air by just calling 646-TALK. 952, or if you just want to remember Mendota Heights, you can always check the area code there. 457-5506, 457-5506, 457-5506, and a 457-5506, and there's lots of candy and tricks at 457-5506, and 457-5506. Get out there and get your kicks at a 457-5506, area code 952. That's the thing. It's going on right now if you want to head out there now and have some fun. You can just go out there and enjoy yourself. It's going, I think, till midnight tonight. 679 Marie. Marie and Dodd in Mendota Heights. It'll go on tomorrow night. It'll go on Sunday night. Go through Halloween in the evenings. But do, if you have it in you, do volunteer, especially for tomorrow night. They may need help on the other nights, but they said they were hurting for tomorrow night. 952-457-5506. Big occasion, Soft Hands. Big occasion
yep.
today. Big anniversary.
Today is officially Radio Day, and you want to know why?
Radio Day! Radio Day!
today marks the 86th anniversary of the issuance of the very first commercial radio broadcast license by the federal government.
First broadcast license, very first license.
Now, there was no FCC back then. You know who issued the license?
The FUC. No, the...
Watch it.
The... Who?
The U.S. Commerce Department, which I guess makes sense if you think about it.
Yep.
It was on this date in 1920 that Westinghouse was granted a license for station. You know the call letters? First commercial radio station?
No, what was it?
KDKA. Where was it? Or where is it?
Well, I know what side of the Mississippi we're on. We're on the east side of the Mississippi with that.
That's correct. Even though that probably...
Philadelphia!
Ooh, you're warm.
Pens! Pittsburgh.
There you go. I knew you knew it. Now, it got the license today, 86 years ago, but it did its first broadcast a week later on Election Day, which fell on November 2nd that year.
And, interestingly, was covered by the parents of the Polachicks and Ron Rosenbaum's grandfather.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Cool. They did provide the results of the presidential race that year. Of course, you know who won, right?
Heaver Hoover.
No. No, Harding.
Harding Hoover.
Harding beat Cox. And they provided it for the first time ever before their listeners could read about it in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their second broadcast, if I'm not mistaken, was a college football game that same fall.
And a famous college football game because there was a guy in the press box with a telescope and a buzzer who relayed it to a coach on the sidelines who got the calls the other team were making. And that is covered in the book, More Echoes from the Freakin' Green.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then there was the situation later on in the Masters where on the 18th, I think it was the famous Tom Weisskopf who went down and was killed from a shot from the grassy knoll. And he went down and died right there on the 18th, and that's called the aching green. The dead guy on the green. Dead guy in the middle of the green. Dead guy in the middle of the green. Dead guy in the middle of the green. Stinking to high heaven. Someone carry that guy off. What the hell? It's a Tom Weisskopf. Who the hell bumped him off? Nobody knows. What the hell are we doing, Saltance? You're a professional newsman. You're an Eddie R. Murrow type. Why are you participating in this nonsense?
Do you Tommy.
Do you have any other weird news stories?
Not with me at the moment, I'm afraid.
Through you? In you?
No.
Under you?
But I did think we ought to take note of Radio Day today, seeing that we are on the radio.
So let us celebrate together with the radio theme song, ladies and gentlemen. First broadcast. What the?
Watson, come quick. I need you.
Speed was talking to me during the break. He was saying that Oktoberfest, what do I have to look forward to when I purchase Summit Oktoberfest? And I said, yeah, it's not complex, Speed, it's beer. I know, it's Summit beer. It's real beer, it's good beer, but it's still just beer. That means water, hops, barley, yeast. That's it. What do you have to look forward to? Here's what you have to look forward to. An opportunity to possibly fall in love all over again with flavor. The simple joy that comes with wondrous flavor. You will either love it or leave it. It is so simple with Summit. All this complexity, what's it all for? It comes down to this. You open a beer. You pour it in a glass. You drink it, and you either like it or you don't. Forget the commercials. Forget the scantily clad girls and the music and the baseball advertisements. All of it. It's just a matter of how do you feel when you sip it? Alive? Free? With it? No strings to tie you down? No chicks to hang you up? Unless along comes Ellen with her long dark hair, crazy idea about kicks and Heyman, red Corvette, and off you go on a two-for-the-road block in a town on the brink of disaster, playing the lead role in a drama of human emotions that explodes into a nightmare. All you want to know is this going to work for you? Summit says to be Mishki, it isn't rocket science. Just get them to sip it. They'll like it and be grateful that you told them about it, or they won't. What's the loss? They tried a beer, but it's a local beer. And don't you want to try the local beers first before giving your money to some clown out of state? Think about it. Summit Brewing Company, St. Paul, Minnesota.
AM 1500, KSTP.
He makes a one-handed catch against the bullpen. Oh, doctor.
Out on the porch in the summer heat, the sound of a southerner's voice filled the street. Me and the redhead were up in the catbird seat. And out in St. Louis, it was surely the same. Holy cow, what a baseball.
Minnesota Twins arrive here for the first time in close to half a century, leaving their old home, coming over to where radio is still local. Mishki, AM 1500 KSTP. Ladies and gentlemen, there are complaints coming in. We're handling them fast and furiously. What we have is a near riot outside the walls of KSTP. Charlie Brown's Halloween special, that classic, has been interrupted by a debate. And I'm sad to say the people responsible are the people here at KSTP. Somehow deciding for you that it's more important that you learn about the issues of the day prior to the big election than celebrate this wondrous holiday in a childlike fashion by watching that favorite of all of ours, a Charlie Brown Halloween. The Great Pumpkin. You know, I got coal in my bag. That sort of thing. I understand your complaints. I empathize. I, too, would be upset. Come on. Another politician talking about the same old stuff. The stuff they've been yakking about for months. The stuff they'll be yakking about next year and the year after. How about giving the people a little credit to do the research on their own, to learn on their own, and decide who they want to vote for, and allow them on a Friday night to enjoy Charlie and the gang and this Halloween weekend? I'm with you, people. I don't mind turning on this microphone and attacking the very people who put food on my table. They allow that here. It's called freedom, and it's very American. Now, I'm about ready to march up to Mr. Hubbard's office and give him a little what for. I don't expect that to go over real well, and I may not be working here come Monday. In fact, there's a good possibility with what I'm going to do when I go off the air that I will not have this show at this time come Monday. I'm warning you now. This 5:30 to 7:30 gig, it's been a hoot. But I'm willing to risk it, and I have a feeling a powerful intuition, a powerful intuitive sense, I should say, that it's going to all end shortly. I thank you so much for sticking with me from January of 2006 through October. And I only hope that I find another place to land, another place to turn on the microphone and visit with you. I love you people. Wait, no, I don't. I don't know you very well. Hello, Jim.
And Tommy, I was just going to tell you, this is your last night broadcasting in the daylight. Next week it'll be dark when you're on the air at 5:30.
No, next week it won't be dark when I'm on, Jim, because I won't be here next week.
Seriously?
Yeah.
They're not renewing your contract?
Well, Jim, I just think with what's going to happen here in the next 20 minutes upstairs, I'm not going to be able to hang on to this slot. It's a big-time slot. This is Drive Time Radio, and I don't know that I have the ammo to hang on to it. I'm firing blanks on a lot of respects here at KSTP, and with a stunt I'm about to pull concerning this Charlie Brown Halloween special being usurped, I just don't think I'll be here. And I just want you to know, Jimmy, that I've enjoyed this run. I really have, and I've enjoyed your participation in it, but I don't think I'll be on in the nighttime next week, nor the week after, nor the week after, nor the rest of the year, nor all of next year.
Oh, so they're moving you from noon till 2.
Wow. You're good. You're really, really good. I've always been impressed by your intellect and your insight, and I only ask that you keep it to yourself, lest others find out. It's a big station secret. Okay? Don't tell anybody. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Beginning Monday, the Mishki broadcast will air noon to 2 here at AM 1500 KSTP. I knew it was time to move from this slot August 1st when I heard the Minnesota Twins were going to be here next year. Come on. 7 months a year of a one-hour show, babysitting the radio station between Souchere and the play-by-play? No, that wasn't for me. I didn't get into this business for the money. I got into it for the joy, the creative joy of just getting up every day and having a full show to tackle, to take on, to play with, like Plato. I need my 2 hours. The only place left to find that here at AM 1500 is noon to 2. I'm game. I'm ready. I'm looking forward to it. Just between you, me, and the fence post, I hope to die at noon to 2. I hope to live out the rest of my days at that slot. I hope to be a old man here at KSTP, still working noon to 2, 5 days a week. Doesn't always work out that way, but I can hope. I hope you find me there. And if you don't find me there, I hope you find the podcast. And if you don't find the podcast, I hope you understand that this had to happen. As soon as the Twins were going to be a part of this station, it had to happen. Back to late nights, you say? Nah. Twins are going to be on at night, and then after there will be post-game shows and that sort of thing. Nope, only place left for me is noon to 2. And I go there with a big smile on my face, and renewed energy and vigor, ready to take on a new time slot and try to turn it into a magical 2 hours of radio here in the Twin Cities. Hope you'll look for me there from time to time. I'll be listening for you. What do you guys sound like? High Speed is eventually going to follow me there, but he can't go just yet. He has duties here in the evening. So on Monday I'll be with Kodiak, my old pal who used to produce the show, before I went to town on him with a bunch of rebar and crippled him. I hurt him badly, and he's sore about it, but like Branca and Thompson, we'll find a way to get along. until high speed can arrive. Sorry about the Charlie Brown special. I'll do what I can here in the next few minutes. But Mr. Hubbard's bigger than I am. Remember to check out ScareTheFoodOutOfYou.com. Get over to that haunted house in Mendota Heights, 679 Marie. Marie and Dodd. Just bring a can of food. No money involved. Help out the less fortunate and get scared in the process. Or call them about volunteering. They need help tomorrow night. Have a wonderful weekend.